Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 169 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In this podcast, I'll be talking about nephrotic and nephritic syndromes. Kind of getting a lot of requests from people to please make a podcast on nephrotic syndrome. So basically what I'm going to try to accomplish is I'm going to cover it from the step 2CK, step 3 perspective, and then I'll also cover it from the step 1 perspective. So basically, if you listen to this podcast, you should know essentially everything you do need to know about any of the nephrotic syndromes, at least the high yield ones that are commonly tested on exams. So let's just jump into it. So basically, right, these are glomerular diseases. The big thing, and again, I'll sort of talk about it in layers. So you may see me talk about the same thing three times, but each time I'll talk about something slightly different. So let's start from the clinical perspective first, right? Let's get like the quick and dirty stuff out of the way, right? So obviously, if a person has a nephrotic syndrome, right, the big thing you want to look at is the protein excretion in a 24-hour period, right? So if you're excreting more than 3.5 grams or 3,500 milligrams of protein in a 24-hour period, that's nephrotic syndrome. One thing you may see on the upper level exams like 2CK, step 3, the internal medicine exams, they can tell you that the person's urine protein to creatinine ratio is greater than 3.5 grams per gram, or like greater than 3,500 milligrams per gram. Those things all qualify for nephrotic syndrome. And again, what are the classic findings in nephrotic syndrome, right? The person will have like low levels of albumin because they essentially peed out in the urine, right? They'll have like edema, because remember, if you have low levels of albumin, then your oncotic pressure in your blood is gone to crap, right? So you have low levels of albumin, your oncotic pressure in the bloodstream will go down. So you have extravasation of fluid, so that will cause edema. And then these people will also get hyperlipidemia, because again, when the body liver notices that your oncotic pressure is low, your liver is like, what is going on? So it will try everything in its power to raise oncotic pressure, so your liver will make a ton of lipid. So these people tend to have a hyperlipidemia. That is why in general, when people have a nephrotic syndrome, you tend to treat them with statins. And again, the thing is, for the most part, nephrotic syndromes, they can be like some primary causes of nephrotic syndrome. But on the other hand, you can also have some systemic diseases causing nephrotic syndrome, right? So things like diabetes, amyloidosis, right? Those things can all cause a nephrotic syndrome. So what are the big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with nephrotic syndrome? The first maybe big one you want to understand is like FSGS, right? So like focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, right? For the most part, you want to consider this if you see like a nephrotic syndrome question in an African American, right? So in a black person. And this thing, there are certain high yield risk factors that tend to pop up on tests, right? So if a person is an IV drug user, like a heroin user, right? That's a classic presentation of FSGS. If a person has HIV, in fact, they tend to have like the really bad prognosis FSGS. It's known as the collapsing FSGS. Okay, that's actually a variant you definitely want to know for your exam. And then people that are obese, okay, like morbidly obese people, they also tend to have FSGS, right? And really the way you make the diagnosis, so if they're asking for a diagnostic test on your exam, you do a renal biopsy. And really the way you treat is you can give steroids, you can give like glucocorticoids, or you can give like cyclosporine, right? Those are the treatments for FSGS. Problem with FSGS is about 50% of people with FSGS, they progress to chronic renal failure. And then the next big one I'll talk about, right, is like membranous nephropathy. Sometimes you may see it referred to on exams as membranous glomerulopathy. Okay, so either term actually works. And really, again, if you're thinking about a white person with nephrotic syndrome, this is what you should go after. Right. And one oft not paid attention to concept on exams with a membranous nephropathy is that this has an association with antibodies against the phospholipase E2 receptor. OK, antibodies against the phospholipase E2 receptor. The NBMA loves to test this stuff. And again, there are many things that can cause this, right? Like people that have like solid cancers, like colon cancer, lymph, stuff like that, they tend to have membranous nephropathy. Contrast this with minimal chain disease, where those people tend to have more liquid cancers. By liquid, I don't mean like the cancer is liquid. I mean more like hematologic malignancies. Hematologic malignancies have a stronger association with a minimal chain disease, right? So some other things can also cause membranous nephropathy, right? So like Hep B, Hep C, right? If they give you a question about a person that has membranous nephropathy in an African country or something, you want to think about malaria. Believe it or not, malaria can actually be a cause of a membranous nephropathy, right? And the thing is, of all the nephrotic syndromes, remember that in nephrotic syndrome, you lose a lot of proteins in the urine. One of the big proteins you lose in the urine in people that have nephrotic syndrome, especially like membranous nephropathy, is antithrombin 3. Remember, antithrombin 3 is an inhibitor of factor 10 and factor 2. So when people have nephrotic syndrome, they lose antithrombin 3, there's less inhibition of factor 10 and factor 2, so those people become hypercoagulable. Okay, so one of the hypercoagulable syndromes you want to associate with membranous nephropathy on your exam is a renal vein thrombosis. So if they describe a person that has a history of membranous nephropathy or some history of some weird nephrotic syndrome, and then they present with like sudden onset severe flank pain and fevers, you really want to think about renal vein thrombosis. And again, membranous nephropathy, you do a biopsy, right? And for the most part, you give steroids, right? Or you can actually give So typically, you can do one of two things. You can give cyclosporine as monotherapy, or you can combine steroids and cyclophosphamide as the treatment, right? And the thing is, if a person has like Hep B at the same time as the membranous nephropathy, you also need to treat the Hep B at the same time, right? And remember, Hep B, right, the treatment is, you can give interferon, but really on MBM exams, probably the most common treatment for Hep B is the combination of emtricitabine, lamivudine, and tenofovir. Okay, so I'll say that again. Emtricitabine, lamivudine, and tenofovir. The mnemonic I've always given people to remember that is Hep Belt. So the B is for Hep B, and then the E is for emtricitabine. The L is for lamivudine. The T is for tenofovir. And then the next big nephrotic syndrome, right? Like minimal chain disease. Again, if you see a kid with minimal chain disease on your test, with nephrotic syndrome on your test, that's minimal chain disease, right? Although you can also get minimal chain disease, believe it or not, in adults, right? So again, just something to keep in mind. It's actually relatively common in adults, believe it or not. But classically on the USMLEs, they go after this in kids. And the reason it's called minimal chain disease is when you do like light microscopy, you literally see minimal change. But in electron microscopy, you want to remember that you see like podocyte food process effacement, right? So the thing is, when you have a podocyte food process effacement, you'll lose the negative charges that you typically find around those podocyte food processes. So that can then cause like certain proteins, right, to leak into the nephron, right? And again, remember the association of like liquid malignancies, association with NSAIDs, that's a big thing to know, right? And it also has an association with like upper respiratory infections. Okay, and again, the way you make the diagnosis, you do a biopsy, you give steroids for treatment. Really, for the most part, most people that have minimal chain disease, they almost very rarely proceed to a chronic renal failure. Contrast it with like FSGS, about half of the people that have FSGS will ultimately progress to an end-stage renal disease. And then the next big one I think I will talk about is like diabetic nephropathy, right? If you're thinking about like secondary causes of the nephrotic syndrome, diabetic nephropathy is like right up there. And one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with diabetic nephropathy, right? You don't need to do a biopsy for this, right? For the most part, it's a clinical diagnosis. You see like microalbuminuria in a person that has like a prolonged history of diabetes. And obviously, right, the way you want to treat this, you want to give like an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, right? To slow down the progression of a diabetic nephropathy, right? And remember that for the most part, you want to, try to control the person's glucose, control the person's blood pressure. Now, one bizarre thing that your friends at the MBME have started going after on these exams with diabetic nephropathy is like when you should start like checking kidney function in a diabetic. The thing is, if you have a type 2 diabetic, at the time of diagnosis, you need to measure the albumin to creatinine ratio, right? To again, just check their kidney function. But if you're dealing with a patient that has type 1 diabetes, you start 5 years after the diagnosis has been made. Believe it or not, this is one of those bizarre things that essentially everyone gets wrong on exams. But hopefully you don't get it wrong because you paid attention with this podcast. Now, so those are, again, all big things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, right, just again, I've kind of talked about like the specific treatments for these different nephrotic syndromes. But just in general, right, again, if a person has nephrotic syndrome, they should get like, get statins, right, for the hypercholesterolemia. Again, you want to put them on anticoagulation if they get like the renal vein thrombosis or anything like that, right? If they have like really bad edema, you can put them on like a loop diuretic like furosemide. And one thing, right, and I'll probably mention this again later, right, but remember that some of the classic findings on urinalysis in people that have nephrotic syndrome, you'll see like the Maltese cross pattern, especially from like the oval fat bodies, okay? Those are all classic things that present with nephrotic syndrome. Now, quick drive-by of the nephrotic syndrome, right? So I think if the nephrotic syndrome is cold, I think of nephrotic syndrome as hot, right? So in the nephrotic syndrome, you tend to have more like inflammation of the glomerulus, right? So, these people tend to have like hematuria. They tend to have like what is called nephrotic range proteinuria, right? So like 24-hour urine protein collection of less than 3.5 grams, Okay, and these people tend to have, again, like this, if you do your analysis, you tend to find like red blood cell casts. But the thing is, your friends at the NBME, they may not necessarily put the term red blood cell casts. They may put the term dysmorphic erythrocytes on your test. Okay, they all mean one and the same thing. And these people, for whatever reason, they tend to have like periorbital edema. I don't know why they get the edema in those places, but periorbital edema, hypertension, those are pretty classic findings in nephritic syndrome. Right, and again, like I said, dysmorphic erythrocytes, red blood cell casts, one and the same thing. Now, what are some big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with nephritic syndromes? Remember, like, so again, let's just do a quick drive-by, right? So, like, a big one is like good pastures, right? So, good pastures, you essentially make autoantibodies against like the alpha 3 chain of type 4 collagen, right? So, it's a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. The classic presentation will be like a young male, and this young guy will have like hematuria. Right, and this young guy will also have hemoptysis, because it so happens that type 4 collagen is found in the basement membrane of the glomeruli, but it's also found in the basement membrane of the pulmonary vasculature, especially like the pulmonary capillaries. Right, and the thing is, one high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with good pasture syndrome, sometimes it's called anti-GBM disease, so anti-like glomerular basement membrane disease. The thing is, if you perform immunofluorescence, you'll have like a linear pattern. Okay, a linear pattern. Again, those are all high yield things to know. And then one other class of nephritic syndromes you want to know about, right, are like your post-immune glomerulonephritides, like your Wegener's, your microscopic poly. Remember, Wegener's, the name has changed to GPA, right? So like granulomatosis with polyangiitis. And then there's also microscopic polyangiitis. And then there's Churg-Strauss. But again, Churg-Strauss, the name has changed to EGPA, right? So like eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. The thing is, these post-immune or glomerulonephritides, the reason they are called post-immune is that when you do like immunofluorescence, you will not really see like much in the way of deposition of like antibodies or complement, right? But the thing is, these things, for whatever reason, not all of them, but for whatever reason, they generally on NBME exams tend to cause something called a rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. I'll define that again, a rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. Basically, the thing that defines an RPGN is that you just progress from normal renal function to like bad renal function over a few days to weeks. That's why it's called rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. And the classic histologic finding in people that have RPGN is like a crescent, okay? Basically, the thing that happens is that some of your mononuclear cells, like your monocytes and whatnot, they leak through the glomerular basement membrane into Bowman's space, and then they proliferate, and that's what gives the crescentic appearance on a light microscopy, right? So sometimes rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis is also known as crescentic glomerulonephritis. Again, those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And again, I will talk about like, again, some of the other nephritic syndromes. Like these ones are for the most part like type 3 hypersensitivity reactions, where you have like an antigen antibody complex, like IgA nephropathy, for example. So that'll be the one that shows up like, you know, like 1 to 2 days after an upper respiratory infection or like a GI infection. And then Henoch-Schönlein purpura is like the systemic manifestation of IgA nephropathy, right? Where those people have like, you know, they'll have like the hematuria, they'll have like abdominal pain, and they'll have palpable purpura below the buttocks, right? And then I'll talk about like lupus nephritis, where like they have like the wire loop appearance on light microscopy. And then at some point, I will also talk about like membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, where those people tend to have like the subendothelial tram tracts, right? And then I will talk about post-infectious glomerulonephritis again, where they tend to have like the subepithelial humps. So in just terms of these like weird electron microscopy findings, let me just summarize them here real quick, right? So if a person has minimal chain disease on electron microscopy, expect to see the podocyte food process effacement. That's the buzz phrase you want to remember. In a person that has post-infectious or post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, those people tend to have subepithelial humps, right? In a person that has membranous nephropathy, the classic finding on electron microscopy is a subepithelial spike and dome, okay? In a person that has membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, those people tend to have subendothelial tram tracts on electron microscopy. People that have lupus nephritis, they tend to have a wire loop appearance of the glomerular basement membrane, okay? So those are, again, just unique electron microscopy / light microscopy features you want to store at the back of your mind for NBME exams. Okay, so good pasture syndrome, again, right? I kind of talked about it. Alpha 3 chain, type 4 collagen, you make autoantibodies against it. It's kind of unique in the nephritic syndromes that it is actually a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Believe it or not, your friends at the NBME, they love this stuff, right? Like trying to see if you can differentiate one hypersensitivity reaction from the other. Right, and really for the most part, again, like I said, for good pastures you give steroids and cyclophosphamide. You can also do like plasmapheresis to kind of get rid of the nasty antibodies. And again, if you do immunofluorescence, you'll see like linear deposition of like the immunoglobulins. And then the post-immunoglomerulonephritides, right? So again, these people have hematuria, but typically they tend to get like RPGN or the crescentic glomerulonephritis, right? And the big ones you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? You want to think of like, you know, like Wegener's, right? Again, remember Wegener's is also known as GPA, granulomatosis with polyangiitis, right? So the classic presentation of Wegener's is a triad of like hematuria from the renal failure, right? Hemoptysis from like lower respiratory tract disease, and then sinusitis from upper respiratory tract disease. But the thing is, your friends at the NBME, they realize that every human being has memorized the term sinusitis. So they're beginning to throw in exotic upper respiratory infections as the third part of the triad of granulomatosis with polyangiitis, right? So they're beginning to throw in things like mastoiditis, otitis media, saddle nose deformity, right? Eustachian tube dysfunction, as all, like, those things all count as sinusitis in the purview of the NBME for Wegener's, right? And remember that Wegener's is associated with antibodies against the proteinase 3, okay, which is also known as C-ANCA. Essentially, Wegener's is the only C-ANCA-related pathology you probably ever learn in your test-taking career as a medicine physician. Well, unless someone discovers something completely new that is C-ANCA positive, right? And then you want to think about, like, again, microscopic polyangiitis. That one is very non-specific, but it's like P-ANCA, and it usually shows up in people that are over the age of 60, okay? And they will have, like, fever, right? So you see, like, a person that has hematuria, has fevers, they're over the age of 60, and they have, like, P-ANCA positivity. They'll literally need to tell you the answer to the question in the question, because microscopic polyangiitis is very non-specific, but remember that it is P-ANCA positive. Now, contrast this with Churg-Strauss. In Churg-Strauss, remember, another name for Churg-Strauss is eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Churg-Strauss tends to present in people that have like a pretty storied like asthma history, right? So these people may have like a history of asthma or like really severe allergies. And then they will give you like a CBC, and you see that these people have like just a crap ton of eosinophils, right? If you see that in the setting of hematuria, think about eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. And remember that it's P-ANCA positive. And if you remember earlier, I said that C-ANCA is associated with antibodies against proteinase 3. P-ANCA is associated with antibodies against myeloperoxidase, right? So sometimes your friends at the NBME, because they know every human being has memorized the terms C-ANCA and P-ANCA, they may do things to kind of mess with your head, right? So they may put, instead of putting C-ANCA on your test as an answer choice, they may put anti-proteinase 3 antibodies, right? Like anti-proteinase 3 ANCA. Or instead of putting P-ANCA on your exam, they may put like anti-MPO ANCA, okay? So like anti-myeloperoxidase ANCA. So you definitely want to know what the terms C-ANCA and the term P-ANCA mean, okay? So that's, again, a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then, like I said, right, people that have these post-immune glomerulonephritides, again, on immunofluorescence, you won't really see much in the way of antibodies. And one classic thing that I feel like really helps on NBME exams with these three diseases, like the microscopic polyangiitis, Wegener's, and Churg-Strauss, is that the complement levels are typically normal in these diseases. So again, that's something to keep in mind. And again, for the most part, your treatment on exams, you can do like steroids and cyclophosphamide. Sometimes you can do like a rituximab. That also does help under those, under certain circumstances. And then IgA nephropathy, right? Again, you'll be a person that has like hematuria, like, you know, 1 to 2 days after like an upper respiratory infection or a GI infection, right? And the thing is, again, the way you make the diagnosis, you do like a kidney biopsy. Again, complement levels are normal, right? So one thing that I've really found to be helpful for these like nephritic syndromes is just knowing which ones have normal complement, which ones have low complement. And really, IgA nephropathy, most people tend to recover pretty well, although some people may have like multiple recurrences. And really, for the most part, you really don't need to treat IgA nephropathy on NBME exams. And I mean, sometimes you can, you know, maybe toss in like an ACE inhibitor and ARB. But for the most part, you really don't need to treat IgA nephropathy. And then the close cousin of IgA nephropathy, right, like the systemic manifestation of IgA nephropathy, like the vasculitis associated with IgA nephropathy, essentially is like Henoch-Schönlein purpura. Right, so again, they essentially have like the same findings on like microscopy as you have in IgA nephropathy, but these people again typically have like about palpable purpura below the buttocks. Again, you don't treat Henoch-Schönlein purpura. Again, your friends at the NBME, they realize that most people have memorized that, oh, nephrotic syndrome, always treat. No, not so for like IgA nephropathy and HSP. IgA nephropathy and HSP are rarely treated on NBME exams. So again, that's something kind of unique you want to keep at the back of your mind on tests. And then, right, if they describe a person with like a history of like Miller rash or like positive ANA, right, or they may say that, oh, the person has like positive anti-Smith or anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, right, and then they tell you that all the complement is low, like C1 is low, C2, C3, C4, everything is low. Sometimes pathologists call this the full house pattern. Whenever you see that, you want to think a lot about lupus nephritis. And lupus nephritis, right, like some of them, like there's like 5 or 6 different types, if I'm not mistaken. Really, like knowing those different types probably doesn't make much sense from an NBME perspective, but you want to recognize this term. Sometimes on the NBMEs, they may put something known as diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, okay? Diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, or DPGN. That's actually one of the most common, it tends to show up as more like a nephritic syndrome in people that have, lupus, right? And, again, remember the association of like positive ANA, anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies or anti-Smith antibodies. The anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies tend to be, you know, like when a person has those things positive, it tends to like correlate with like the presence of a lupus nephritis. And then remember your post-infectious glomerulonephritis, right? So I will actually explain the mechanism behind this in a bit, but again, I want to cover like the high level step 2 CK, step 3, step 1 stuff, and then I'll start going into the weeds a little. But basically, right, people that have post-infectious glomerulonephritis, the big thing that happens is that, you know, they'll have like a strep, like upper respiratory infection, right? So like strep throat or something like that, or they can have a strep skin infection, right? So like erysipelas or impetigo. And then afterwards, like 1 to 6 weeks after, right, you know, they'll have like hematuria, they'll have low complement. So complement is low here, okay? Remember, I've essentially said two things that are associated with low complement. Come on, Divine, think. So post-infectious glomerulonephritis is one. And then, what was the second one I just mentioned? Lupus nephritis, right? Those tend to have a low complement. So again, very high yield to know that. And again, 1 to 6 weeks after an upper respiratory infection or strep skin infection. And, you know, you check some key antibodies like ASO titers, so anti-streptolysin O titers. You check antibodies against the anti-DNase B antibodies, right? Remember, those are actually more specific for like strep skin infections, okay? So again, those are big things to keep at the back of your mind. And then I think probably the last big one I'll talk about is like membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, right? So remember, again, this is actually one of those ones where complement is low, okay? And typically, they may give you like a weird situation where the person's C1 and C4 are normal, but the C3 is low. Like the only thing that is generally low in membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis on NBME exams is C3. The reason that the C3 specifically is low is, right, many of these MPGNs, at least there's a specific one, I think it's known as like dense deposit disease, so basically like triple D, where they have this thing called like C3 nephritic factor. C3 nephritic factor is a C3 convertase, right? So, you know, always break down C3. So these people's C3 levels are like dramatically low, but every other thing will be normal, okay? And remember that this membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, again, it has like the subendothelial tram tracts on electron microscopy. And, you know, kind of has like certain associations like Hep B, Hep C, lupus, right? Membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, believe it or not, can be actually be a presentation of lupus. And again, like I said, complement is very low, especially C3, right? So again, those are big things you want to keep in mind. So I think maybe this is maybe like, you know, not the worst time in the world to kind of go into the weeds a little. Not necessarily the weeds, but let's say maybe like more the step one stuff that classically shows up on tests with regards to these nephritic syndromes. Again, I've kind of talked about the high level stuff, but let me sort of give you like some understanding of pathophysiology. I think this will be probably especially useful for people taking step one, or people that are taking step two and they just like, okay, Divine, I don't want to, you know, just memorize like random crap. I kind of want to actually understand what's going on. And again, I'll review some of the high yield things I've already mentioned again, just to kind of help you out here, right? But post-infectious glomerulonephritis, right? Again, typically happens after a strep infection, right? So it can happen after like streptococcal pharyngitis. And one thing that you may see on step one is that they may try to trick you and like they may make like, you know, very vague, very weird question asking you about like, oh, that that are the strains of group A strep that cause an like post-infectious glomerulonephritis, kind of like the same as the strains that cause rheumatic fever. That's actually not true. They're actually totally different, right? So it's very different strains of group A strep that cause post-infectious glomerulonephritis. They are called like the nephritogenic strains of group A strep. They are very different from the ones that cause acute rheumatic fever. That is actually one of the primary reasons why if you take antibiotics for like strep throat, it will decrease your incidence of rheumatic fever, but it actually does not increase your incidence of post-infectious glomerulonephritis for that reason, because it's just different strains of the bug that cause those problems, right? And again, the thing is, the pathophase here is that essentially when your body makes antibodies against group A strep, the thing is that those antibodies can cross-react with antigens that you find in the glomerulus, right? So you essentially form an antigen-antibody complex, and then complement comes and destroys everything in its wake, and then you have like inflammation of the glomerulus. And again, don't forget the association with having this like 1 to 6 weeks after an upper respiratory infection, okay? And again, remember that you may see like your classic, again, subepithelial humps. And again, the key antibodies you want to keep at the back of your mind, you want to keep like your ASO titers at the back of your mind. You want to think about anti-DNase B titers, right? And then there's this thing called, it occasionally pops up on NBMEs, like anti-hyaluronidase, okay? Anti-hyaluronidase, that's like a classic presentation on NBME exams. So again, all big things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then for people taking step one, right, like when people have post-infectious glomerulonephritis, if you perform immunofluorescence, you'll see something called a granular pattern. Basically, most of these antigen-antibody complex nephritic syndromes, on immunofluorescence, you see like a granular pattern with one very good exception, right, which is Goodpasture syndrome. Goodpasture syndrome, remember, it has a linear pattern on immunofluorescence, okay? So again, those are all big things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Now, the thing about there is one weird biostats, or let's say like epidemiology. I don't know, this word is just kind of hard to pronounce sometimes. So weird, like I'll just call it epi. If you see me here, see the word epi, I mean epidemiology, right? So one weird epi concept that you may see with post-infectious glomerulonephritis is that when people have a PSGN, if it's a kid that has it, like it's like 1% or less that end up progressing to like RPGN or getting to like, you know, like chronic renal failure. Contrast this with an adult that gets PSGN, they tend to progress to like chronic renal failure in like about 40% of adults that get a post-infectious glomerulonephritis. So that's like a difference in incidence of chronic renal failure in people that have PSGN between like adult, like kids versus adults, that you want to keep at the back of your mind for NBME exams. And then again, like I said, if you ever hear the term RPGN, again, it just means that these people progress from normal kidney function to just badness, like just super badness within like these 2 weeks. And again, the classic finding on histology with rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis is the presence of a crescent, right? It's the presence of a crescent. And again, remember that it tends to have an association with the post-immune glomerulonephritis, right? So like microscopic polyangiitis, Churg-Strauss, which is known as EGPA, or eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, or Wegener's, which is known as GPA, right, granulomatosis with polyangiitis. But again, the formation of crescents is the big primary pathophysiology you want to keep at the back of your mind. And basically, like I said, right, in people that have RPGN, the reason they form crescents is that they have like just super terrible damage of the glomerulus. And when that happens, you'll essentially have like fibrinogen and like your mononuclear cells leaking into Bowman's space. And then those mononuclear cells will proliferate like a ton, right? To, you know, kind of like almost like because they are participating in the inflammation, and you will essentially form a crescent. Okay. So people that get like these RPGNs, they can literally progress from like normal renal function to like complete renal failure within like a few days, right? And again, like I said, the post-immune whatevers tends to be like the classic causes of RPGN on MBME exams. And then, like I said, microscopic polyangiitis, right? Big things you want to keep at the back of your mind. It's a P anchor positive, right? So like anti-MPO anchor. So anti-myeloperoxidase anchor. The reason, again, you may see, Devon, you're repeating certain things over and over again. I'm not repeating these things for funsies. I'm repeating them because they're actually high yield to know for exams. And again, I'm just trying to like, because again, right, nephritic syndromes, nebulous subject for many people, right? So I feel like if I describe it, because notice I'm repeating the same thing, but I'm attacking it from different angles. Like before I give you like, you know, the high leveled key buzzwords to remember, but now I'm kind of beginning to like jump into pathophysiology a little. I feel like if you understand this from all these angles, you'll probably never get a nephritic or nephrotic syndrome question wrong on any USMLE exam, all the way from step 1 to step 2 CK to step 3, or the internal medicine board exams even. So again, microscopic polyangiitis will be a person, you know, more than 60 years old, has fever, has weight loss, and then they tell you that they have like hematuria or dysmorphic erythrocytes in their blood, in their urine, on your analysis. If you see that, think about a microscopic polyangiitis, right? And then membranous nephropathy, right? Remember, it is actually, in fact, I'll maybe put it this way. Membranous nephropathy, the literature keeps changing every year, but it's one of the most common causes of nephrotic syndrome in adults, right? And again, remember, it tends to occur like, you know, in white people. And again, because it's a nephrotic syndrome, right, you're losing more than 3.5 grams of protein in the urine in a 24-hour period. And really, many cases of membranous nephropathy, there are some key associations you want to remember, right? So, like, if a person has, like, Hep B, Hep C, right? If a person has, like a solid cancer, right? Or if they take certain drugs like NSAIDs, right? And also, lupus can be a presentation of membranous nephropathy. In fact, if you see a person that has lupus and has a nephrotic syndrome, think about membranous nephropathy. If you see a person with lupus and they have nephritic syndrome, think about DPGN, diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis. Okay, and then don't forget that, again, this thing is, I promise you, this is one of those things you'll very likely see on an exam. Membranous nephropathy has an association with antibodies to the phospholipase A2 receptor. Okay, the phospholipase A2 receptor. And then remember the classic finding on histology, right, is the subepithelial spike and dome. Okay, the subepithelial spike and dome. And again, remember, you lose antithrombin 3 in your urine, you get renal vein thrombosis because you have less inhibition of factor 10 and factor 2, right? Renal vein, like the nephrotic syndrome that has the strongest association with renal vein thrombosis is membranous nephropathy, okay? And then, I think those are probably, you know, like the big things I want to mention with membranous nephropathy. Again, it's an antigen-antibody complex disease, right? So like the complement binding region of the antibody in the antigen-antibody complex, you know, activates the complement cascade, and then everything goes haywire, and then you inflame and destroy the kidney. And then remember, a minimal chain disease, right? Again, most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in kids. Remember, right, that normally, right, you know, you have your glomerular basement membrane, and that, you know, it's kind of lined by like fenestrated endothelium. And then, you know, you find your podocyte food processes. Well, the thing is, those podocyte food processes, they get effaced. So what does he mean by effaced? Effaced just means that they essentially like fuse together, right? When they fuse together, they essentially lose like their negative charge. And when they lose their negative charge, albumin begins to leak through those food processes, right? And then the person ultimately gets a proteinuria with that. And again, for the most part, if you see minimal chain disease, you can give steroids. Most people that get minimal chain disease, you know, they recover pretty well, right? And then FSGS, right? So like focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, right? Remember that it's called focal because it's less than 50% of the glomeruli that are affected. And then it's called segmental because it's not the entire, so if you're looking at one glomerulus, it's not the entire glomerulus that's affected. It's a small part of the glomerulus that is affected. And this, on electron microscopy, you'll also see, again, the classic podocyte food process effacement. To be perfectly honest with you, the two nephrotic syndromes that you want to associate with like podocyte food process effacement is FSGS, so focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, and also minimal chain disease. Those generally are associated with the podocyte food process effacement. And again, remember that FSGS, right, like more than half, more than half of patients with FSGS, they progress to like chronic renal failure, usually within like 5 to 10 years. And one weird genetic mutation that your friends at the MBME may want you to kind of keep track of with regards to FSGS is the MPHS1. I just think that, like, it's kind of easy to remember. It's like almost like recurring letters. Is like nephrotic syndrome 1 and nephrotic syndrome 2 mutations. Although I think they are called like nephrin, if I'm not mistaken, like nephrin gene mutations. So MPHS1 and MPHS2 mutations are associated with FSGS. Okay, and again, remember HIV, obese person, IV drug user, right? And in HIV, they tend to get a collapsing FSGS. There's a kind of FSGS that has a pretty good prognosis. It's called like the, tip link form, right? It has a pretty good prognosis. And then on the other end of the spectrum is where you have the collapsing kind that is just terrible, 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 and awful. And then MPGN, right? So membranous proliferative glomerulonephritis. Again, remember the association of like Hep B, Hep C. It can be associated with lupus, right? And the thing is, when a person has a MPGN, right, you have like the tram tracts, but they are not subepithelial, they are subendothelial, right? So people will have like the subendothelial tram tracts in membranous proliferative glomerulonephritis. And then there is almost like a subset of MPGN. It's known as dense deposit disease. Just think of it as triple D. Basically, the thing that happens is, you know, you have like on electron microscopy, you have this person that has essentially like a very, or let me say clinically, you have this person that has like, you know, like an MPGN style presentation. But instead of seeing like the subendothelial tram tracts on electron microscopy, you may see these things called like dense deposits. They're almost like ribbon shaped. So I don't know if I pronounced it right. Some people pronounce it as ribbon. Some people pronounce it as ribbon. So like RIBBON. Basically, you have like these ribbon-shaped masses around the basement membrane of the glomerulus, and they sort of like come together. And again, the big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with dense deposit disease is the presence of something called a C3 nephritic factor, right? So in C3 nephritic factor is literally a C3 convertase, so it will clearly break down a lot of C3. So these people tend to have like normal levels of C1 and C4, but they have like a profound decrease in their C3. If you see that, I really want you to think about dense deposit disease, which is like a weird variant of membranous proliferative glomerulonephritis. And then IgA nephropathy, right? So again, remember, this is also known as like sympharyngitic nephropathy. The pathophysiology always like, you know, boggled me for a while, but really, if you kind of think like, again, from like kind of like digging through the literature and kind of reading like a bunch of books, the thing is, IgA nephropathy just typically starts as, it's called IgA nephropathy because you have like certain subtypes of IgA, like IgA1. It kind of gets like a weird like glycosylation pattern. And when you have that weird glycosylation pattern, remember that, I think I may have mentioned this in my intro immunology podcast where I talked about like PAMPs, so like pathogen associated molecular patterns. The thing is, weird patterns of glycosylation tend to, you know, kind of like attract the immune system a lot, right? So the thing is, you may have like, these people may have like IgA1 with like a weird glycosylation pattern. And then the thing is, we actually form antibodies against those like glycosylation patterns. So that forms an antigen antibody complex that then kind of like deposits within like the mesangium of the glomerulus. And then you have all this inflammation and you ultimately destroy the kidneys. So the thing is, you may say, okay, Divine, you are saying that it's the antibody that gets glycated and then you form antibodies. It's like IgA that gets glycated and you form antibodies against it and then everything becomes terrible. So why is this associated with having like an upper respiratory infection or like a GI infection? Well, here's the thing. Again, coming back to that thing I talked about earlier about pathogen-associated and molecular patterns. The thing is, like viruses and bacteria, right? Some of these bugs, on like the surfaces of their cells, they can express this thing that's called like N-acetylgalactosamine, okay? So notice the name, N-acetylgalactosamine. So that means it's something that has, again, like a glycosylation pattern, right? The thing is that glycosylation pattern on those bugs, the body can make antibodies against those. And again, they'll form an antigen-antibody complex. And then that thing deposits in the kidney, especially like the mesangium of the kidneys. And then everything becomes super bad. Okay, so hopefully that kind of gives you an idea as to why like the presence of an upper respiratory infection or a GI infection tends to be associated with the development of our IgA nephropathy. And then I think maybe the last thing I'll talk about, Alport syndrome, right? So Alport syndrome, right? It has a classic triad. I believe it's like can't see, can't pee, can't hear a high C, right? So can't see, can't pee, can't hear a high C. So typically these people tend to, you know, it's inherited in an X-linked dominant fashion, right? And FYI, there are two X-linked dominant diseases you want to know for the USMLE exams. The first one is Alport syndrome, okay? The second one is... Second one is a fragile X syndrome. Remember, fragile X syndrome has like a weird association with like CGG, trinucleotide repeats. So, Alport syndrome, you know, X-linked dominant. So again, the classic presentation, can't see, right? So those people have like eye problems like cataracts or like dislocation of the lens, or they can have like weird development of the cornea. And then can't hear, can't see, can't pee. So the P is like, you know, the nephritic syndrome they have. And then can't hear a high C, right? So they can have like, a sensory neural or hearing loss. So you usually see, you know, like multiple people in the family have like these problems, like, oh, like dad couldn't hear. Uncle couldn't hear, just, you know, like weird cluster. Once you say like diseases in multiple family members on MBM exams, they're essentially telling you that it's a genetic disease. So the big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, again, like I said, X-linked dominant inheritance, and remember that the mutation is in the alpha 2 chain of type 4 collagen, right? So don't confuse the alpha 2 chain of type 4 collagen that's screwed up in Alport syndrome with the alpha 3 chain of type 4 collagen that you make antibodies against in good pasture syndrome. Okay, so alpha 3 for good pastures, alpha 2 for Alport. So you may say, oh, Divine, how do I remember which is which? Remember that A comes before G in the alphabet, so 2 comes before 3 when you're counting numbers. Okay, so alpha 2 for Alports, alpha 3 for good pastures. Okay, and you want to remember that it's a mutation in the gene, so again, type 4 collagen, but you want to remember the specific bus phrase COL4A5, okay? A COL4A5 mutation is what gives rise to Alport syndrome, okay? So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I kind of feel like this has gone on for long, but really, like, if you know everything in this podcast, then you'll be like a master of... Like, I'll be stunned if you got a nephrotic or nephritic question wrong on literally any exam. Because I've intentionally tried to, like, talk about it from, like, the basic science perspective, the clinical presentation perspective, the diagnostic perspective, the treatment perspective, the histology perspective. So, like, I just cannot think of any other thing they can test that I really did not talk about. So, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? So step 1, step 2 CK, step 3, step 2 CS, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. And then I also offer tutoring for the internal medicine ABIM board exams, the internal medicine in-training exam. And then I do this thing called longitudinal tutoring, where if you're a first, second, or third-year med student, I tutor you for like your block exams or like your third year shelf exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exams. Again, I've done this with tons of people that have all been wildly successful. And then I offer like these USMLE booster courses. It's like 10 hours for step 2 CK and step 3, but it's 20 hours for step 1. And basically, it's something you do at the end of your dedicated period of wait when you feel like, you know, your knowledge base is up to snuff. And then in a Q&A fashion, I put everything together for you, basically. I review like most of the high-yield concepts from all the various disciplines that are tested on those respective USMLE exams. And then if you're, you know, like a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one, I guess you can call it advising or coaching for those. So like, you know, rec letters, personal statements, application editing, mock interviews. I've done that with tons of people. And again, the vast majority of people I've worked with have all matched in their first choice of residency. And then if you're an international medical graduate, I actually work with a ton of IMGs. I have worked with IMGs that have, you know, been through like very difficult like residency application circumstances. And again, like pretty much every IMG I've worked with has matched, right? And most of them, I've worked with people that have failed the USMLEs multiple times and they have come back and done extremely well, right? So again, if you're in any of those circumstances or you know like a US medical student in any of those circumstances, feel free to have them reach out to me. And then finally, I do offer like one-on-one tutoring, like for like the MCAT and like for like many college like pre-med courses. So like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, offer tutoring for all those things. So if you need any of those things, feel free to reach out. So hopefully you've gotten something from this podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast, which will, I believe, will be episode 170. God bless you. Thank you.